This is Ron Frank with the Vietnam Archive, speaking with Don Choden on March the 6th. Mr. Choden served on the LST 1096.
And I've been trying to contact him here this past week to see if he would, you know, want to participate.
Okay.
And I haven't been able to contact him. I would rather talk to him before.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And then if he's agreeable, I have your email, and I'll send you an email and give you.
No, that would be great. Yeah, if he's willing to be a participant, I'd love to be able to talk to him.
Yeah, he's the only one that I would call that's still on the ship at that time, or that I have had any contact with. Enough to have his phone number.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
There's not too many that I've been in contact with.
Okay. Well,
so,
let me.
I'll give you any information I can, Ron. And I really appreciate this opportunity. I think it's thinking back, a story that probably needs to be told.
I absolutely agree, and I was sort of amazed as I was looking through the literature of history to see that really it hasn't been. I mean, there's been a couple articles here or there in some of the Navy journals, but for the most part, the whole story hasn't been told.
Yeah.
And so that was my goal, my motive behind the whole thing.
Okay, I'm ready whenever you are.
Oh, great. Well, let's go ahead and begin. The first question I have is of a more general nature, and it really involves my interest in knowing a little bit about how you got yourself into the U.S. Navy and then aboard the LST 1096.
Okay. In 1950, some of my friends, a little older than I, were on the list for be drafted, and their decision was to join the Navy to avoid the draft, and so I went along with that.
Okay.
So we were draft dodgers, you know. And we joined the Navy in January of 1951 with the hopes of being together, and my two friends were twin brothers. As it turned out, they were standing on the street corner waving at me as I left on the Greyhound bus.
Oh.
But they followed a couple of days later, and we only saw each other two or three times during our 4 years in the Navy. But that was the way I came to be in the Navy.
Okay.
And after boot camp, I went to a radioman school in San Diego. And after that, I was assigned to the 1096.
And you served then during your tenure in the Navy on the 1096?
Yes, for the rest of the time in the Navy. I was on the 1096.
And what rank did you hold on the ship during the operation?
Radioman, second class. Radioman.
Okay. And that's, I mean, I imagine your primary duties were probably similar to the title. But if you wouldn't mind just giving me a little bit idea of the different types of responsibilities you had.
Well, my sole responsibility was in communication.
Okay.
In operations of the radio gear aboard the ship. And at that time, I was the leading petty officer in the radio gang.
Okay.
And we had about six radiomen that fell under my supervision.
Okay.
But our main duties were is to maintain contact with the flagship and to maintain communications with any shore installations that we were able to.
As you came by them?
Yes. Matter of fact, when we first went to Vietnam, which we our first port of call there was Haiphong Harbor, which was the border at that time between North and South Vietnam, and later it was moved south to Haiphong, I understand. We tried for, you know, a couple of days to make contact with the advanced medical team that was in the area that we were supplying.
Okay.
Which we were unable to do. They were less military and more medical.
Right.
And they didn't maintain communication, or at least radio communication. So, and that was Dr. Tom Dooley's.
That's right, yeah, on the Montague?
Pardon?
He was on the Montague at the time.
At the time we got there, I think he had already established some kind of a center of operations, either very near or in Haiphong.
Oh, okay. That's right. He was on shore. I guess he arrived. He was arrived on the Montague, and he was the ship's doctor for them, but did a lot of work on shore at the time.
Right.
Where was your ship deployed when you heard about the Operation Passage to Freedom?
We were on maneuvers with the Marines in Okinawa, and prematurely we broke off from that and were ordered back to Yokosuka, Japan.
Okay.
The crew at that time really didn't know what the what was in mind for us. But we went back to Japan and loaded supplies, and as I recall, it was either Army medical supplies, mobile hospital type supplies, and then proceeded back to Haiphong.
Okay. Were you very aware of the situation that was occurring in Vietnam when you found out you were going to be part of this operation?
No. In fact, before it was announced to the crew just what we were supposed to do or going to do, our main source of information then were the officers, wardroom stewards. And as I recall, the steward gave us the complete rundown of just where we were going and why. And it turned out it was correct. So.
Okay.
But once we got there, of course, we knew what our duties were going to be. And then Dr. Dooley, of course, came aboard and gave us the whole political situation rundown.
So you did have contact with Dr. Dooley then?
Yes, and that seemed to make things a lot easier to accept at the time with of that type of duty, which is pretty isolated.
Sure. Tell me, really, what were the primary responsibilities of the LST, the 1096 specifically?
When we first arrived there, we acted as a station ship at Haiphong, and they had moved a Marine helicopter aboard for transportation of Dr. Dooley's people and the VIPs that were in and out of there.
From your craft to the shoreline?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the helicopter is actually stationed on our craft with a pilot and a crew, and we were anchored right in. It was more like a river than it was a harbor, as I recall. But,
yeah. Did that remain your the primary responsibility?
After we had served as a station ship for a while, we did transport some equipment south. And then on another trip, we transported some of the French troops with their Vietnamese dependents.
Okay.
Whether they were wives, girlfriends, or there were a lot of children involved. But the French troops were, which I was a really an interesting point for us at the time. All of the French troops that we embarked were French foreign legionnaires.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And they were from equatorial Africa and complete with their tribal scars on their face.
I've been told that they were pretty intimidating.
Yes.
Is that, that's a pretty fair assessment?
yes. They were intimidating to look at, but it turned out that they were, there were no problems.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And, I think they were thankful that they had a ride out of town.
Now, did you or the LST itself have any special type of preparation to assume the role of a transport ship for refugees?
Not as a not as a planned type of preparation, but. Our previous duties, the year or so before, had been transporting prisoners of war from Korea to the prison camps, and then once the armistice was underway, transporting those prisoners back to Korea for repatriation. So that was really the only preparation we had of handling human-type cargo.
Okay.
I hate to use that that characterization, but...
But that, I mean, essentially that's what you were doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever, were you ever to go ashore in North Vietnam?
As I recall, Liberty Party, which I was in, we did make it into Haiphong one time.
Oh, you did?
And it was a very brief thing, and I don't think we were allowed to visit any of the inns or cabarets, or we were cautioned about eating the food. So,
right. Well, you were actually the first person I've talked to that was able to go ashore.
And as I said, it was a very brief great thing. It was just more or less a daytime sightseeing thing. And we walked the streets and back. But then, of course, in Saigon, we did have liberty. And,
right.
Which was really a beautiful city at that time.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, what do you remember about Haiphong itself as a city at that time?
Well, that's just it. I don't recall that much about it. I do recall that there were a number of huge merchant ships at the docks, which seemed to have a very modern docking facility, and that's really about all I remember about it.
Okay. Okay. Did you, let's see, do you remember anything about, I mean, actually, about the conditions at all of the way the maybe the people were, or the buildings?
The buildings, as I could see in Haiphong, from what we could say, were, then they, nothing had been destroyed, or it was a lot more run down than, say, Saigon was.
Okay, yeah.
I do recall that.
Now, how did when you said you loaded equipment and then later on some the French Foreign Legion, and then refugees. How were each of those groups taken aboard the LST?
We were able to beach there at Haiphong, and they were loaded in through the bow doors. Are you familiar with an LST?
I've seen some pictures, yeah. But if you, I mean, you can be as descriptive as you'd like. That would
yeah,
be great.
Well, they were constructed with a shallow draft, so they could run the bow right into the beach, and it had bow doors that would swing open left and right, and then a ramp that would lower down facilitate the loading of equipment or personnel, so forth. And as I recall, that's the way they were loaded. I do recall watching the teams that were on the beach disinfecting the civilian refugees.
Yeah, I guess
With DDT.
Right, yeah, they sprayed DDT on them.
And this sticks in my mind because the dress of a Vietnamese was a long smock type thing that maybe went to their knees, the split side, and then a pair of trousers. Or pajama bottoms that just tied on each side.
Okay.
And the medical teams, of course, would spray their hair with the DDT and then put the nozzle inside their pajama bottom and spray them. And once they got over that initial fear, allowed that to happen, then it was squeals of delight. When they'd get sprayed.
Oh, really? I guess, yeah, I imagine it's probably the first time they had a cleaning like that, too.
Yeah, they were, in fact, they were reluctant and fearful, really, of having that done until some of the team, Dr. Dooley's team, allowed itself to be sprayed to show them that it was not harmful.
That makes sense. That kind of leads into my next question about the general condition of the refugees, and really what I was interested in, and you've explained a bit already, about their appearance and their health and their wealth in the sense of what they had with them and their emotions. I wonder if you wouldn't mind just elaborating a little bit on that.
Well, the ones that we had aboard, of course, as I said, at least I presume that they were dependents of the French troops. They were probably in a lot better condition than most of the refugees that were evacuated at that time. I recall seeing some of them that were coming down the river from the north. And they look like a pretty wretched group of people. But that's not the type of refugees that we had aboard our ship. So I really can't comment on that much more than that. I just don't recall.
Okay. But it certainly was a different type of refugee.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. And you said before Dr. Dooley showed them what to do, there was a certain amount of fear.
Yes.
And going through.
Yes. Of course, they just didn't know what to expect. They were very backward people.
Yeah. Did you get a sense, or others, that perhaps there was a little bit of how should we say, prompting by the Viet Minh, the Vietnamese communist, in spreading some propaganda to these people? that might have encouraged them to be a little more fearful?
Well, this is one of the things that when Dr. Dooley came aboard our ship and gave us the talk, that he said that this is what you're going to, this is, expect this to see this, that they have been, there's been a lot of propaganda about what's going to happen to them, so you're going to see a lot of fear in these people because they've been indoctrinated to expect it.
Right.
And, so after his spiel, we had a lot better sense of just what was going on.
What was his countermeasure to that? How were you to deal with the potential fear or anxiety of the refugees? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I think it was just a matter of what it seemed like, that we just had to gain their trust first, and this was done before they came aboard.
Okay.
And
now, did you when the refugees came aboard? Did you have much interaction with them?
No.
Okay. Other than probably just watching them come aboard and things of that nature?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So you didn't ever have any instances where you had to communicate a certain thing to the group?
Well, not in my responsibility. I recall that the shore team had one Marine, I believe, that spoke French, and that was about the only way that they communicated with a lot of the people that came aboard our ship.
Did your ship have a chaplain?
No.
Okay. One of the things I've learned is a lot of the ship's chaplains spoke Latin.
Uh-huh.
To the priest who spoke Latin. That was the common language of communication, which I thought was rather interesting. Now, I guess the next question would be, once you had all the refugees aboard, or the Foreign Legion troops aboard, what was the next step?
We took them, I think both trips, we went south to a port called Touraine.
Okay, yeah.
Which I now believe is Da Nang.
That's correct, right.
Is that?
Yes, sir.
I think I had researched that at one time or another. When the situation changed in Vietnam, and I kept hearing these names, and I went back and saw that Touraine had been now Da Nang.
That's right. It's now Da Nang. That's correct.
And then we proceeded on south to Saigon, and I just don't recall what the purpose of the trip to Saigon was, but we were able to go ashore there and have liberty.
So the refugees themselves, they were disembarked at Touraine?
Touraine.
Okay.
The ones that we.
The ones that you had?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's, see, now I hadn't realized that the refugee population, part of them were dropped off there.
Well, since they were part of the French troops that we embarked on, maybe perhaps that's just why.
It makes a lot of sense. Were you able to go ashore there, or was it just simply drop off and then head down to Saigon?
Just in and out of Touraine. Okay.
How long did that trip take?
I don't recall.
Okay.
And I have no idea of the distances involved.
I know the attack transports usually took about 2 to 3 days,
mm-hmm.
but I might be mistaken. I think they probably have a little more power than the LST.
LSTs were very slow.
Yeah,
10 knots is about the limit.
And then after you dropped off that first group, you went down to Saigon?
Yes.
What were you able to do down there?
I don't know what the purpose of the ship's trip, having the ship go down there was, but while we were there, you were able to have liberty and go into the city of Saigon and sightsee and visit the cafes and restaurants and so on.
What did you think of Saigon at the time?
It surprised me how modern the city was in that part of the world. Cathedrals and some of the large department stores and the wide streets and so forth. But my impression was that it was a modern, booming city at the time.
You were a pretty young man at the time, I would think.
Yes, I was 23, 22.
Did you come in contact with many of the Vietnamese in Saigon?
No.
Okay. How about the French Foreign Legion troops?
No.
Okay. I know that some...
Personally, you know, we just more or less kept to ourselves.
Yeah. What else? I mean, I'm curious. I've been to Saigon in 1999, but I really am kind of interested to know what it was like in 1954, because it really was a completely different city, even a completely different country at that point.
Uh-huh.
What other types of things do you remember of... about the city itself?
The things that stood out in my mind was the French influence, I suppose. I knew nothing of the French, but you could tell that there was a French influence here with the sidewalk cafes and things of that nature. And a very short distance, we were able to walk around the city, and a very short distance from the downtown area just seems like you stepped across the line into a very rural type setting.
Yeah.
And,
well, now after you had your liberty, you went back up to Haiphong, or did you make another trip down?
We made only two trips.
Only two trips.
Yes.
Okay.
And that was from August, middle of August, to sometime in November. But for the most time, the 1096 spent as a station ship there at Haiphong.
What was that second trip like in terms of the population? Was it the same population of refugees?
I think the second trip was equipment only.
Only equipment?
Yes.
Now, was that the old Marshall Aid equipment?
Well, it was some of the... it was the French... military equipment.
Okay.
Which was really probably the Marshall Aid type equipment. It was all United States government previously.
Okay.
Type equipment, jeeps and trucks and so forth.
Any tanks?
I don't recall any tanks. No.
Okay. So I know they did transport a lot of the 2.5-ton trucks that we had supplied.
What I recall the most part of. It was that type of equipment.
Do you recall the condition of it? Because I talked to another gentleman who remembers the equipment that was on his craft at the time, his LST.
As I recall, it didn't seem like to me at the time that there was much to salvage. It was in pretty bad condition.
Oh, really? Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, he actually, the stuff they had was brand new on his.
No, what we saw was, had been used.
Okay.
Extensively.
Yeah. I guess, maybe if we could, when you went, going back to being the station ship, I'm curious, because I hadn't heard about that. I'm wondering if there's anything that you can add a little bit about its responsibilities. And I know the Estes was a flagship in the beginning, but I hadn't heard about this particular responsibility.
perhaps they didn't call it a station ship. This is might be more or less my characterization of what we were, but since we had that helicopter aboard and we were available to Dr. Dooley's team, I just more or less characterized it in my own mind as being a station ship.
Well, there's a certain amount of logic to that. I would agree. What other types of personnel were you able to ferry in and out? I'm thinking more along the line. I don't know if Admiral Sabin ever went ashore or any of the Task Force 90 people.
I don't recall anyone actually coming aboard other than Dr. Dooley. The Marine helicopter would be stationed on our ship and then would depart to make runs between other ships or shore and other ships and so forth, but not necessarily through us.
No VIPs or of that nature,
no.
Really?
No.
I'm wondering, you know, Dr. Dooley, he wrote a book on this operation and certainly was, I think, a pretty vocal spokesman for what the U.S. Navy was doing at the time. What were your impressions of him as a doctor and an officer of the U.S. Navy?
Well, he was more or less a hero as far as I was concerned. I thought that at the time, after learning some of his background, and I never knew if it was completely true or not, but he was from a wealthy family. I don't know that as a fact, but that was my understanding. And the wonderment in my mind was what would motivate someone with, to sacrifice as much as he did.
Yeah.
And, of course, I read his books, and there's three books, in fact, that I
have. That's right.
And I think he was just a very humanitarian. I guess that's the only thing that I can say.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I agree with you 100%. A new book came out on him, which I don't agree with, but they argue that he was more of an egomaniac. And I just, from the people I've talked to, I haven't got that sense at all.
I sure didn't get that from what he was, from our contact with him, and which was really limited at the time. It wasn't his desire to aggrandize his own actions, or it didn't seem to.
Yeah.
And he would come aboard our ship to, you know, maybe take a shower and get a good meal and a change of clothes, and was grateful for that.
And just go back into the field.
And right back to the mud.
Yeah, really doesn't fit a that kind of person that some of these guys have made him out to be. Were there any other individuals who stood out in your mind?
No, that was. I don't recall anything else that really stood out.
When
I know when we first. Just as a side, they had planned for some type of action against the ships when they first got there. In fact, when we were anchored right off the coast at Haiphong, they had ordered small boat patrols to patrol around the anchored ships. And as an exercise to check the security, they had our Navy frogmen that actually came aboard one of the LSTs and took the skipper hostage.
Really? Our fragment as an exercise.
As an exercise, and of course that that made security paramount. Land from then on in all the ships.
Well, was there a real threat of the Viet Minh threatening the anchored ships or even those that were?
Maybe it was just routine security. I really don't know if there was any actual threat or not, and I never heard of any actual action against any of the ships.
Was there a worry about maybe some of those refugees getting aboard that might have been agents for the other side?
If there was, it was at least not in my mind.
Okay, or probably...
It was never brought forth as that.
Probably something that was taken care of before they actually boarded.
Of course, they were confined to one area of our ship, and we had posted security to keep them in that area.
Did you ever stand watch?
Not one of the security watches, no.
No, okay. Do you think that your participation in this operation and seeing the people heightened your awareness of Vietnam in the 1950s after the operation was done?
Oh, definitely. It did, and it gave me an understanding of just what
sort of feelings and emotions did you take away after the LST left Indochina?
Well, I don't recall any specific ones, but at the time when we left there in November, we visited Hong Kong, and I was so close to being separated from the service man that I left the ship in Hong Kong, so I guess that probably occupied my emotions.
Oh, sure.
Time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, looking back on it now, I mean, what even today when I found you on the internet, and what came to your mind when I mentioned the project?
I was excited about it. Where I heard about you was on that website of the LST.
That's right. That's right.
And I stay in touch with things on there, and it's a good a diversion from daily life.
Oh, absolutely.
Look at that, I really enjoyed the adventure that was involved in that type of operation, or that operation, because it was different than most people that were in the Navy at that time were involved in. Most of it was in the Pacific, was in Japan and Okinawa.
Well, it definitely was a different type of operation.
And it gave us a it broadened our lives just a little bit to see what was going on there and to see the French influence in Vietnam, and made us more aware, I think, of, or at least me, of the colonialization of places like Vietnam.
Yeah.
And,
well, if you were to turn back the clock and you had a chance to do it all over again, would you do it again?
Yes, I believe I would. I believe I would.
Which probably, it's safe to say that you would characterize in the operation as a success, or would you see it as, in a sense, a long-term failure?
The operation itself, of course, the whole Vietnamese thing was, once it got so political, and it was a lost cause.
Yeah, but in terms of just the operation?
Yes, I think it was. The only thing, the only thing that I have thoughts on, my negative thoughts was that perhaps with more ships involved, there could have been more more people moved into the south.
Yeah.
Now, of course, if you expand on that with the comment that you brought up about the northern agents being among those refugees, it could have a negative effect. The more we got out of there, the more agents we got.
That's right. You never,
yeah. So
you never know.
Hindsight.
Well, let me ask you if there's any other sort of memories or stories or history that you would like to have included to make sure that the 1096 is represented well, that I simply haven't addressed.
I don't think I can't think of anything that I could add to that other than just our participation in it. And, I was telling my son about it, what it was going to do, and I said, I really don't remember a lot of things, and he said, well, make something up.
Oh, please don't do that.
Of course he was.
He was joking, yeah.
He was trying to be facetious.
Well, one of the things I'm going to...
That's what I'm afraid of with a lot of history that I read, Ron, but maybe that has happened.
Well, it does. I mean, one of the things that I'm going to be able to do is when I go out to Washington, D.C., I'll be able to visit the National Archives and the Navy Yard and get the deck logs and some of the other written documentations,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be able to use that with the stories and the memories of those that I'm able to interview. So I'll be able to intertwine them and confirm things when they need to be confirmed. So I, you know, after 47 years, memories change. They have to.
Yeah.
So I'll be able to, when there's a problem, you know, I'll be able to go back through and then maybe even re-interview people on specific things,
mm-hmm.
that maybe they just didn't get right. But what I really haven't found that to be a problem. I found most things to be very consistent from the people I've talked to, which is very nice, even after this number of years. But what I'd like to do is after I go through and if I'm able to get the deck logs for the 1096, and I'm hoping that they'll be in the National Archives, if there's anything that I find that I have a question about, can I give you a call back? And then maybe if you might be able to shed some light, or maybe I'll be able to trigger a memory that you just had forgotten for a while.
That would be fine. I'd be happy to.
And certainly in like terms, if after we're done, if you remember something you'd wish you had told me, just send me an email,
mm-hmm.
and we
okay.
can arrange a time to talk again, or you can relay the story via email as well.
Well, I'll contact this other shipmate of mine and see if he would be willing to give his views. And if so, I'll drop you an email.
Well, that would be great. I really do appreciate that.
I was talking to one other shipmate we met on the discussion page, and he had left the ship before we went into that operation.
Oh, okay.
And I really didn't remember him, but we got to hashing over some of the things that did happen during both of our periods when both were on the ship. And it was some things that I remembered that he didn't, some things he remembered that I didn't. So.
Well, that's one of the neat things.
Thing can jog your memory. Sometimes.
Yeah, I've discovered, and I'll be able to go to a couple of reunions of some of the different transport ships,
mm-hmm.
is... I've been able to generate actually quite a bit of discussion on this topic, and all of a sudden these, you know, the whole story emerges after a couple guys get together because they all have pieces to the overall picture. That's kind of neat. It's been very interesting for me, very eye opening. So I've enjoyed it.
You're at Texas Tech.
That's correct. Yeah, I run the Vietnam Archive here at Texas Tech.
Your website.
Oh, okay. And then, I'm also
quite involved.
Well, yeah, and
Where
then
are you? What city in Texas?
we're in Lubbock, Texas,
Lubbock.
right? And then I teach in our honors college. I teach a course on the Vietnam War.
The shipmate that I was mentioning to you is from Austin, Texas.
Oh, okay, so not too far.
So,
Not too far at all. Well, hopefully
I'll
he'll
continue to try to contact him.
yeah, hopefully if you're able to get a hold of him, he'll be interested. And you know, the thing I've told everyone, when they say I don't remember much, a little bit is better than nothing, as far as I'm concerned. If I can get a whole bunch of little bits, then I'll be able to, I think, I have a much better history when it's all done.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing, Ron, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to participate.
Well, good. And I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to talk to me.
You're entirely welcome.
And again, as I go on, if I find something new, I'll jot you an email. And you know, if I find anyone else on the 1096, I'll let you know about them too.
Okay.
You never know who I can find.
Right.
Well, good. Well, you have a great afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. And that concludes the interview with Mr. Don Schoen, Schoen, served in the LST 1096. And today is the 6th of March, 2001, and it is.